Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rink, Jack Spencer, and our special guest this week, Matt Resch from Resch Strategies, and John Selleck. He's got his new company called Harbor Strategic. Join us for the podcast. And John is qualifying for best podcast guest ever. He not only brought pastries and donuts, he brought mimosas. Selleck, this is fantastic.
Hey, we got to kick off spring break. It's a big week.
No, you're just trying to show up Andrea Bightley because Andrea Bightley promised that she would bring baked goods to her next MERS podcast, and she did not.
Well, I thought if I bought them at Strange Matter, I couldn't burn them, so I've got at least a step up on her till her next appearance.
I thought that Strange Matter wouldn't serve their donuts in this plastic, unrecyclable container, though.
Did you check the bottom, though? Does it have the recycled symbol on it? Maybe it's recycled.
Maybe it could be. Let me check. No, it doesn't have that little triangle on there with the air.
Someone needs to take a picture and tweet this container out to the world. This could be a rough day for the Strange Matter folks.
Hey, look, if next time we should just do the podcast at Strange Matter, and then we can have the little cute plate.
Oh, that would be really cool. So is this the first time you guys have ever done a podcast together?
Actually, I was lucky enough to appear on Matt's podcast one time just because he wanted somebody to give Ron Fornia a really hard time.
Did you succeed?
Absolutely. He hates me.
When was that one, Resch? I don't remember that.
That was one of the first ones. That was last December. We did it when Ron was the guest speaker at the Lansing Economic Club. We went over to the Kellogg Center, and Johnny helped us, and because he knows Ron pretty well. I had not met him much before that, so John came and helped us out. It was good.
Well, how about that? How long have you been doing your podcast now?
It's been about a year and a half. We started last fall, so we're episode 33 came out yesterday, every other Thursday.
And it's what?
Cold Oatmeal.
It's the Cold Oatmeal podcast.
You know, so for the record, I don't like cold oatmeal.
You should try it.
No, I have tried it. Bridget makes it all the time. Okay, so Bridget loves cold oatmeal, and I just can't get into it. I like the warm oatmeal, and I'll put all that stuff in my warm oatmeal. Like I turn my warm oatmeal into, I use steel cut oats.
Okay.
And I put all that fancy stuff that your guys put in their oatmeal into the warm oatmeal. But I'll just wait for 20 minutes and let the steel cut oats work.
And it's got to be homemade maple syrup instead of sugar.
I don't use maple syrup.
No, I do.
You put maple syrup into your oatmeal?
On top of my oatmeal. Oh, yeah. Instead of brown sugar. It's great.
Do you do that too, Rick?
Sometimes. Honey, cinnamon, brown sugar, anything.
Did you eat oatmeal before the oatmeal?
Not often. Not very much. It was really, the temperature of the oatmeal is really not as important as the oatmeal itself. I think Joe is always in the cold oatmeal because it's faster, and he can just stick it in the refrigerator the night before, head out the door, and eat it.
Did you eat oatmeal before the podcast?
As a child, I ate it. I didn't eat it. Not a ton.
That doesn't make me feel good. I start off every morning with my very quick, very not fancy Quaker 1-minute oats with nothing but some blueberries, maybe a little milk.
Were you inspired by his cold oatmeal podcast?
I thought cold was the temperature of like the interest in the podcast. So when I was on his podcast, it's his podcast. It's like going to his house. I have to be polite at my best behavior.
You've never been polite in my
now
house.
Now it's Matt against me at MERS. I'm unleashed.
Your behavior is the worst at my house.
All right, I love your house. And there's also a lot of alcohol at Matt's house, just like at MERS. So.
So you guys have known each other for quite some time. Was it at House Sadly, Republicans yes. or...
No, it was in Governor Engler's office. He's one of the very first people I met. Because, you know, John has like one joke. And
just one, right?
The first day I met him, I was starting in Governor Engler's office in constituent services. And I think you were in the scheduling office. Mm-hmm. I meet him on the elevator, and my boss was taking me to lunch. And John's stock joke is, are you going to Omar's? he says that joke all the time. And that was the first time I met John.
So. It's because that's where John was going, right?
Yeah, right. So it was 20 years
ago. And he wanted you to join him? Okay.
And then, now I live like in a small town, a friendly small town where people wave and say hi. I can't make jokes like that anymore. Jordan has cured me of that. But I think the first time we actually did something together, I was working on the Engler reelection campaign in '98, and we were in the upstairs of a house, much like this one downtown. And we were getting a little cooped up. It was like 11 at night or something. The governor and the pollster and a few others, maybe Mike Murphy, I think, were in town. They were all locked in this little room. They were conducting serious business. We were out in the other room whipping a ball at each other's heads as fast as we could because we were just losing our minds. We needed to go drinking. And one of them, the governor came out and said, shut up!
Really?
And then the other guy came out and goes, hey, look, I got these basketball tickets tonight. Do you guys want to go see Michigan State versus Indiana? I'm like, oh, I know exactly who to take. My new friend, Matt Resch. He came down from his little downtown house with his red IU hat.
Oh, my God.
And that's where our friendship started.
You knew he was an Indiana fan at that point, didn't you?
Yeah, I felt bad for him.
Because State probably won.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. All right. And then, Jack, you when you were covering the house, these guys were in the house at the time, I think, right?
Yeah, they kind of leaned against the wall and tried to act like they really weren't paying attention to things, except when they were called upon, and then they'd leap to action immediately. And I usually would pick that time to go out in the back room and get some coffee.
Because if they weren't in the room, you knew that nothing important was going on.
Something like that, yes. But the House is different than the Senate. The House, you could actually pick up stuff when no one nonchalantly, when no one even knew you were picking up stories, because you could wander all over. So
some chat did put a kibosh to that.
That's unfortunate, because that's the way.
Tell me about it.
I mean, you used to just wander all over, and it was not like the Senate where everybody's got to go over and basically they get the scrum, and then it's how well the reporters interpret the scrum. And you may pick up something in the hall or something afterward. But the House, you could literally go to different areas and talk to different lawmakers and some come up with some of your best stories all by yourself.
Or you came up with the best stories because Selleck and Resch were talking to each other and you could just overhear what they were saying.
Well, you could do that too, or you could just plain ask them or bribe them or whatever.
That was always the stressful part of that job, because as I was leaning against the wall not paying attention, someone would always come up and say, hey, some reporter's over there wandering around the house or around the floor, and they're talking to somebody. You better get over there and either break it up or figure out what they're talking about.
And that was either Jack or Skubik?
Mm-hmm. Over all those things, kind of self-policed, there was a balance. Every once in a while, a reporter might go too far and a member would get irritated, or a member would go too far and chase down a reporter and the reporter would get irritated. Kind of worked its way out. I just always remember the difference between the House and Senate to me back then was my first day I walked onto the House floor and I started to walk down the middle and I stopped. I was like, holy crap, I should not walk down the middle. And I started to turn to the right and a sergeant grabbed me by the arm and I thought, whoa, I'm toast. He goes, sir, you walk right down the middle. This is the House. This isn't the Senate.
Wow.
Badge of honor there.
All right, so let's turn the page here. Let's talk about Donald Trump in Grand Rapids on Thursday. Let's just play a small audio bit from that rally, and we'll do some comments on it.
You recaptured your destiny. You defended your dignity. And you proudly reclaim your freedom, maybe for a second time.
Yes!
You have always been loyal to me. And now you have a president who is loyal to you. The Democrats took the people of Michigan for granted, but with us, you will never, ever be forgotten again. You will never be taken for granted ever, ever, ever. I am fighting for you and your jobs and your life and your community with everything that I have. And I will never, ever stop. And we are winning so big, nobody ever thought it could happen. We will always fight on victory. Together, we are going to make our beautiful stand. We are going to stand for justice, for safety,
yes,
for sovereignty,
yes,
and for the sacred rights given to us by the hand of Almighty God.
Yes, sir. Yes!
We are one united people, and one United States of America. With a very proud and very truly incredible and inspiring people of Michigan, we will make America wealthy again. And we're doing it. We will make America strong again. We will
safe again. And we will make America great again.
All right, so I see that John Selleck is completely prepared. He's got his notes all written out, typed up here, and so I'm going to turn the mic to him since he's got a fresh donut in his face and say, all right, so.
I didn't know we had to prepare for this.
I always prepare. I'm a prepared person. I went to Michigan State. I didn't go to Hillsdale.
So what was the most striking thing for you watching this Trump rally, John?
I really thought overall it's classic Trump. There was nothing different about it. It had all the elements. It had the unusual music that comes beforehand, a little mix of the Rolling Stones, some opera, some other oddball things that he uses to get the crowd rolling. He comes out and talks about everything he's going to get us, and then he always plays, "You can't always get what you want." That's still, I can't comprehend that one. I really thought overall, though, he checked all the boxes he needed to do. He spoke to the national audience. So it's basically his first big event since the Mueller report came out. And he came out and said, "Look, I'm vindicated. My people are vindicated. They're unleashed. Look at this place. It's packed. Everyone is happy. There's a new breath of fresh energy into my team and into what I'm doing." Second, he was sending a message to Michigan, to all the activists here. He's coming from Michigan. He needs to win in the Midwest again. Some combination of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania are going to be necessary to win again. And then the third universe he was talking to was us, the pundits and the media, saying, "Look, I can win this thing. Look at this Van Andel Arena. I've got it overflowing out into the streets." And no one said that he was doing the, "Oh, there was 32,000 people thing." Like back in 2016, he actually had a full arena and everybody saw it. So he clicked all the check boxes he needed to do to have a successful night.
Having been in the arena, I can attest that it was full. The crowd was raucous, I think, as folks could see. But taking a look at spots in the arena, there was maybe a couple spots where there weren't people sitting, but I think that at a certain point they just stopped letting people in because there was plenty of folks outside watching on the big screen outside Van Andel who were watching as well. I think maybe at some point there was just a fire hazard. They still had lines way out, you know, and going up to about an hour.
Do you think, any of you here, do you think the combination of the Mueller report with that rally makes any difference in Michigan? Because he's upside down in Michigan right now, according to the polls that we've published.
I was curious to know, to the Mueller point, how different that rally would have been had the report not yet come out. We knew he was coming for a month. It seems like they announced this a long time ago. And it felt to me, I wasn't there, but watching the commentary on Twitter, watching people talk about it, just watching the footage of the lines, that there was some sense of energy in the folks who were going, that I wonder if it would be there at that same level if that report had not, if there was not that sense of vindication that we showed them, and now we're going to go and have this big rally. I thought that would be an interesting thing to think about if it hadn't come out yet.
Yeah, I tend to agree with Matt. I think that's all correct. I also think Emerson had polling out recently. It leaned a little bit Republican, and they don't do live calls, but it basically had Trump in the margin of error to everybody except for Biden. So Michigan is in range there. And then we haven't seen a poll yet since the Mueller report came out. So I think that's what will be most interesting. The other thing we haven't really seen is we don't know who the Democrat is. I think this will be an entirely different race once we know which Democrat it is. And like last night, I watched the spokesperson for Trump talking to one of the reporters online saying, "Well, Bernie Sanders and all the rest of the socialists, we know what's coming, whether it's Mayor Pete or Kamala Harris or whatever, it's suddenly going to be a choice." What we've seen in all the polling thus far is, are you totally happy with how the president operates? That's a mixed bag. Once we see it, do you want to pick between the president and X? Then we're going to really know what's going on.
Well, I agree with that. I'll be a little bit of a contrarian. I think obviously this event would have been different if it hadn't been for the Mueller report. But the people that were there for Trump would have still been there for Trump regardless. I think to those people who only watch Fox News, they do not watch MSNBC, they do not watch the other side, the Mueller report was nothing more than being able to say, "We told you so." I think that's all it really was.
The thing is, though, there's no guarantee that inside the hundreds of pages that are that Mueller report, there may not be proof of collusion, but there may be some pretty embarrassing stuff in there. I mean, we don't know what's really in that report other than a four-page summary. So.
Well, and I think, if anything, the last 3 years has shown it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't know if for that crowd, I don't think they care.
It could be recipes for cold oatmeal. And no one who was at that rally last night is going to think, "Oh, well, now I don't like him." And no one who hates him is going to think, "Oh, well, you know, now he's maybe I should give him a second look because Mueller, you know, didn't didn't find something. I think, you know, it's the lots are cast, and no one's changing their mind on this stuff.
The importance of this being in Michigan, you guys, either you guys or John want to talk about that, about how important was it that Trump had this rally, the first one after the Mueller report? It almost kind of felt like the kickoff of the campaign, even though this was an official White House visit. That had all the smell and feel of a campaign. How important was it that it was in Grand Rapids?
Well, you were the only one that was there, so you know how it smelled. Without a doubt, it felt like the start of the campaign and the significance of Michigan. If you just take a little time, if you're a geek like me, you go online, type an Electoral College map. You get to push all the buttons and change the states from blue to red. I strongly encourage Elizabeth Warren to check it out. She might change her mind on getting rid of the Electoral College if she had some fun on that website. But you see that if all the states are starting to go into their corners already, all the states that were swing states when I was on the Romney campaign, where we had state directors, are kind of no longer becoming swing states. Iowa is going the way of the rural areas of Michigan, and it's already polling for Trump. Virginia has moved towards the Democrats. If you mark Virginia for the Democrats, if you mark Florida for the Republicans, which I think will be a fight, Ohio has moved into the Republican column to a large extent. Even if you give the Democrats Colorado and you give the Republicans
Arizona,
exactly, some combination of Michigan, Pennsylvania, just one of them, or Wisconsin could win it for Trump if all those states keep going in the direction that the Republican-Democrat divide is doing between this rural suburban split.
I mentioned Grand Rapids thing, and this isn't about the Electoral College, but I found it interesting that he chose to, you know, once again throw Betsy DeVos underneath the bus in her hometown after putting out a budget that, you know, inexplicably calls for cutting Special Olympics, has her go out and defend it for a week, you know, and defend it tooth and nail because that's the policy, and then comes to her hometown and then says, "Oh, I'm not going to do that." It makes you wonder, like, does he hate her? Because he keeps doing this kind of stuff. I'm putting her out there, and she's doing the good soldier fight and carrying the water and saying what she's supposed to say because of a budget that's going nowhere. And then in her hometown, he says, "Yeah, never mind. Whatever she just said this last week isn't going
to
happen."
Here he cut the Great Lakes funding, and then comes to Grand Rapids and says, "Oh, actually, I'm going to save it." And the crowd goes wild. I mean, the only reason it was in question was because he put it in question. People who were there and people who were not there. So who was there? Bill Huizenga was there. John Molinar was there. Jack Bergman was there. Lee Chatfield was there. Who was not there? No mention of John James. No Justin Amash. What do you guys make of that?
The John James thing is interesting to me. I would have thought he would be there. Justin doesn't surprise me at all. I saw some people tweeting that, you know, national reporters. I mean, he's really kind of taken this mantle, and I think a lot of people are following him. You know, not the never Trump Republicans, the folks who are conservative and are kind of concerned with where the president has taken their brand and their beliefs over the last few years, and he's kind of risen to be a spokesperson and someone to look up to on that side. So it doesn't surprise me that Justin wasn't there.
Yeah, Justin might have been in Iowa, but my sense is John James would have been there unless he had something else going on. He just had a child. He's been on Fox literally like twice a day the last week talking about the president and everything else. And my guess is that was a scheduling issue he couldn't get around. I don't know that for sure, but that's my guess on that front. I thought it was interesting. I was talking to another reporter. Sorry. They were asking me what the president would say about the governor. And remember back in January, the governor went to the NGA meeting and she ended up sitting at the same table as him. And he kind of like fawned over her a little bit.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
She played it smart with him, saying, "Hey, you need to help me with this infrastructure thing." Mm-hmm. Because who knows, maybe he'll do it. And then last night, eventually he jumped and said, "Don't let your Democrat governor take credit for the Sioux locks," I think it was.
Yep.
I think at some point, the Midwest is the battleground. There's a lot of talk in the national press about, will Texas go the other way, or, you know, Georgia or North Carolina are more likely to be in that mix. But really, what we know today is that the Midwest is the battleground, which means they're going to start looking at leaders in the Midwest as possibilities for vice presidential candidates. Mm-hmm. And there's a Democrat in Michigan who's been very careful not to go too far off on the progressive side. She's been the kitchen table candidate and then the kitchen table issue governor. I think Governor Whitmer will end up on these VP lists. And the question is, how fast does that happen? How fast does Trump have to drag her in? And then how fast does that interfere with her ability in divided government to get a solution out of the legislature on roads or on auto insurance? Because we know what that pressure will be like if she is rumored to be, or eventually is, they're going to be under all kinds of pressure not to cooperate with her.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, Jack.
I think there's a lot of dynamics there involved. If that goes, first of all, at this stage, probably you can find somebody in every Midwestern state that's potentially on the list, because that's just the way it always is. I would think that if that was actually true, and that if Governor Whitmer was really interested in that, at some point, Dana Nessel may become a problem for her. In terms of, you know, is she going to go against her own AG on some of these things? I would think she could become a thorn in the side at some point.
Just because she's pressing an agenda that's so far to the left that Whitmer's got to decide, am I going to, you know, stand next to her?
I think as governor, Nessel actually helps her. She can be the one who's always a little bit not as far to the left. Okay. But when it comes to something like nationally and like that, with what she says and what she allows to happen and where she stands on some of those issues, I think she's going to be examined a lot more if she was in really seriously, you know, being considered for vice president. The other thing I want to say, though, what to me stands out, to me, what I heard when I heard he was coming and this was happening this week, I just thought of it as an afterthought, because I think he made his call out to the Midwest when he talked about the closure in Ohio. And when he went after the auto industry and basically my interpretation, I think a lot of blue-collar Democrats' interpretation is, hey, if you guys want to say you're American companies, you better make sure you have enough presence here. And I still think that's why he won Michigan, as well as being ignored and some other reasons. But I still think that's where he got a lot of votes out of places like Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin last time, is those blue-collar Dems that crossed over. And I still think that's what he has to take. I think it's awfully hard as far as the polls go. I could see the Republicans checking out of Michigan in mid-October like they did in previous times, or I could see him taking it. I honestly don't know how it's going to play out.
One thing about the governor's resume to think about is, how does a 45-cent gas tax play outside of Michigan? We live here. We're in the context of that request and that proposal. That is the flagship proposal of her administration at this point. I'll say in air quotes, it makes sense to people in Michigan who are running over potholes every day. Does it make sense to anyone anywhere else in the country when the signature policy initiative of a running mate is to have the highest gas tax in the country?
There are quite a few states, though, that are pushing gas taxes.
Yeah, but Pennsylvania.
But not that high.
They're up there. Right, but she's the proposal on her table is twice as much as the nearest one.
A couple things that I wanted to point out, and maybe you guys can help me with this, but a 90-minute speech, a political speech, and the crowd was eating out of Trump's hand the entire time. And maybe I haven't been to enough of these things, and so Selleck's like shaking his head here, of course. But, I mean, usually these political speeches are, what, you know, maybe 30 minutes, maybe 40. And Trump just seemed like he had this random stream of consciousness going, and the crowd was going nuts. And standing on the floor, the only time I saw people walking out, I think I saw a woman walk out because I think she was claustrophobic and was going to pass out. The guy next to me had a bad back and he kept stretching and he had to walk out. And I saw another guy who was starting to sweat a little bit. But other than that, Trump had him eating out of a spoon. He was spoon feeding these people like nobody else I've ever seen.
Well, if you think about it, his rallies are an improv act. You never know what word is going to come out of his mouth next.
Like bullshit.
Was that being screened?
Nobody told me this before.
Well, no, unless John does it, then we bleep it out. If you throw an F-bomb, right, then we might bleep it out.
But you guys know, I mean, especially when you hang out with national press reporters who are traveling with candidates and who are going to the same rally five times a day, and they can recite the speech. Because every candidate says the exact same thing no matter where they go. You never know what the guy's going to say. I'm not saying that you're going to like or it's going to be entertaining or accurate or whatever, but you have no idea what's going to come out of his mouth. And so that's riveting for people who are going to support that, because they're hanging on every word because it's new to him the second it comes out of his mouth.
What's amazing, though, is that this is conservative West Michigan, where the Christian Reform Church used to reign supreme. And I, growing up in that church, you know, that services, if it went 1 minute over 60 minutes, you'd start hearing the watch alarms go off to kind of remind the preacher. But they sat there for 90 minutes. That's impressive.
It's funny you mentioned church, John. So I started writing down random things that I heard in the crowd, just things that people blurted out. And one of the things somebody blurted out was, I haven't been this educated since I went to church.
So maybe it's not the Christian Reform crowd that was there.
I got a question for you, because you're mentioning the person with the bad back and the other one that was getting dizzy, et cetera. Was it clear to you that was it an an older than average audience, yeah. Do you think?
Yeah, I thought so. But there were still a lot of enthusiastic young people, too. Like this guy who was 6'4 and had a big Trump flag. He insisted on getting kind of the older, smaller people, like my mom, and other people who were just there in front of him so that he could stand by the press area because the press was, you know, in back or, you know, a little further back. But he wanted to stick his huge Trump sign and hoist it way up in the air, I think to block some cameras just to be obnoxious. But yes, it was an older crowd.
But was there a clear reporter section?
Yeah, there was. There was a reporter section, and it wasn't. So if you picture a hockey arena, this is how they had it set up, where the midline would be, where center ice would be. They had Trump kind of pushed in the back to the side where like maybe the penalty boxes would be on center ice. And then the press was on the other side of the ice. So they had a front view of him, and so they could drape the American flag behind Trump. But what that meant is that basically half the crowd could see his face, and the other half could see his back. So if you were sitting in the back of him, it wasn't all that great because the speakers were broadcasting to the front of the auditorium or the arena. But since it was so packed, every seat was taken, so there were a lot of people sitting behind him. Now, at various times when people started doing their chants of USA or build that wall or whatever, Trump would go and turn around and address the people behind him and wave and whatever. It wasn't completely ideal, but that was the only place in Grand Rapids where you're going to get 15,000 people.
What I was wondering, if there was a specific area for the press, did Trump at any time call him out? Look at those people over there. They're dishonest, et cetera, which he's done in the past.
It was pretty obvious where the press was. And so when he gave his usual red meat about the press, people turned around and booed, and there was a lot of that.
I think also looking at that age, it's a good question. But the base audiences for both parties tends to run a little bit on the older side. Those are the people that vote. They have the most time to sit around watching, whether it's MSNBC or Fox. I saw a newsletter from Charlie Cook on the Cook Political Report the other day where he mentioned that exit polling from the 2016 primaries for the Dems showed that 60% of the voters were age 45 or up. So we're hearing a lot about an increase in the vote of the youth vote. So it's going up, but it's not matching the overall where the weight is there. That's why I think we still see Biden leading right now until the game actually gets rolling.
The only like organized youth I saw were the Hillsdale Republican crowd. Matt?
I'm sorry.
Go Hillsdale. There they were. They were proudly represented there, though. They made sure to show up.
You know, that's one of the things that the president of Hillsdale has said things very supportive of President Trump, and it has really surprised me. It has surprised me from the minute he endorsed President Trump. I think that, I don't know, everything that I think of Hillsdale is the opposite of Donald Trump.
Well, we're going to move on to the podcast. We're going to talk with our governor, Gretchen Whitmer. She was nice enough to sit down with us. Let's go ahead and listen to that interview. Join us now for the podcast. We are in the office of Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Thanks for making some time for us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm glad you're here.
All right, so we've all been paying attention to this road funding back and forth, and I'm sure you've seen that the legislature is considering doing the budget first and then tackling roads later. What happens if they send you a budget with no additional road funding money in it?
I am not going to sign any budget that doesn't have funding for the roads in it. It just doesn't work, and I'm not going to sign it. So it'll be a long summer. People need to prepare to work here and stay here until the job is done, because that budget is absolutely interlinked. Our ability to fund our education system, to clean up drinking water, is linked with our ability to rebuild roads in this state. And so I'm not signing anything unless it's all done together.
But you could be seen as holding up the budget. They could take this down to shutdown and pin the shutdown on you because they're sending you a budget.
We're not going to shut down because we're going to stay working here all summer long to get this done. I am serious about it. People of our state elected me because I believe they want me to fix the damn roads. They want honesty in budgeting. They want real solutions, not half measures and shell games. And that's exactly what I've put on the table. I understand that some people may not agree with me on what the solution is. If they have an alternative that gets us to $2.5 billion in additional funding on a yearly basis for the next 10 years, then I'm all ears. But until then, let's get serious about talking about my budget and getting it passed to fix these problems.
One of the things we did last week was sort of survey our readers because we like to see what they think. And 90% don't think you can get that 45-cent gasoline tax hike. What's your reaction to that number? Are you surprised by it?
Listen, you know, people are still kind of reeling from the budget introduction. That's what always happens. I've been through many budgets. I've seen this happen. I knew people would beat on their chest and there'd be a lot of discussion. But I have to tell you this. As I get across the state and I present my budget, whether I'm in Sturgis, Michigan, or Sterling Heights, both of which I've done town halls in, you see the crowd really grasp the magnitude of the problem and appreciate an honest conversation about how we fix it. I've gotten applause everywhere I've gone when I thought perhaps I'd get tomatoes thrown at me. People are genuinely engaged because we are tired of politicians that tell us what we want to hear and don't actually end up fixing problems. That's going to change, and that's why I put the budget on the table that I did.
Would you have any consideration about having commercial trucks pay more, either higher diesel tax or do something with the weights?
So commercial trucks are going to pay more under my plan because they consume four times the amount of fuel as a regular automobile does. The diesel tax goes up the same amount as the fuel, as the gas tax. And so they're going to pay additionally, as will electric vehicles, because under statute their rates will go up as well. Does that mean that we've fixed the disproportionate weight issue? Perhaps we can do better, but they are going to be paying more under this plan.
You've held, obviously, the role of representative, state senator, Senate minority leader. What have you found in the last 3 months that's different about this job, maybe that you didn't expect?
You know, as the leader of state government, there is so much work happening in all these different departments. There's 48,000 state employees. In this week alone, I've made phone calls to the family of a guardsman who died this week. I got a report yesterday about a state employee who was injured in the corrections department because she was being chased by a goose on the grounds and broke her ankle. You know, I mean, there are things like that that I don't think the average person or even legislator appreciates that are a part of being the governor. The biggest surprise, I think, was a few weeks in when we had to declare a state of emergency and shut down state government, use the state emergency alert system, and ask people to turn down their thermostats. But there, I had a few sleepless nights that week because we thought a million people might lose power during the coldest part of that, polar vortex. And we got through it because of the measures that we took. But these are aspects of the job that legislators don't necessarily see, nor do the general public, but are really important and consume a lot of time and energy and thoughtful consideration as we're making decisions.
Have you been following this issue between DMC and Wayne State? And if so, what do you make about a possible solution to that?
I've been following it. Wayne State's an incredibly important institution for the state of Michigan, for Detroiters, for people that are pursuing an opportunity in higher education in the metropolitan area. They've got a unique mission. I think they're incredibly important, and as I watch this play out, I'm very concerned about it. We have one of our big universities has been undergoing a lot of change in leadership and crises, and I don't want to see that happen to Wayne State either. One of the things that's baffled me, though, is I keep hearing conversations around maybe the state will purchase the DMC. I have no idea where these rumors get started, but there is absolutely no conversation in state government about that. We're not in a position to do that, nor is anyone considering doing that.
Okay. Have you ever had a thought about having the lieutenant governor get into the whole IT issues that we're seeing across the state, whether it's DHHS or anywhere else, since that is his background?
Yes, yeah, so the lieutenant governor is really going to be spearheading a number of policy issues from the executive office, whether it's criminal justice reform to expanding broadband, which is squarely in his kind of IT background, to helping streamline some of the IT issues that we have. You know, Trish Foster at the Department of Management and Budget, I think, is doing an incredible job, but she's got an enormous task ahead of her. It's one of those surprising things after taking over from someone who really, this was their background, was computers and technology, to find that we've got such enormous issues to tackle, I think was a bit of a surprise, and it's in every department, and that's something that we are at work on, and certainly Garland's a part of that as well.
The last question that I have for you is, we asked this to your predecessor early in his tenure. Is there anything about Lansing, the atmosphere, the relationships that you think you can change as in this new role?
Absolutely. You know, I served with three different governors. I've served by building relationships with Republicans, and you know, I got some criticism for the few bills that I got signed into law when I was a legislator. But the fact of the matter is, if you don't get caught up on credit, you can get a lot done. And that's how I always operated as a legislator, and that's how I'm operating as a governor. You know, I want to build bridges because I know for all of our benefit, we've got to get back to a place where we can have respectful, honest conversations, robust debate, but ultimately solve problems together. And remember that first and foremost, we're Michiganders before we're partisans. And that's the most important thing that tethers the work that I do and what I want to see in this state. Governor Snyder talked about civility, and I appreciate the sentiment. Every single day, I'm trying to live up to the kind of leader that I think we deserve and we need. We have a unique opportunity with divided government to show the world that it doesn't have to look like gridlock and ugliness that has become Washington, D.C. We can do it better here, and that's what I'm trying to make sure that we do, and that's the culture that I'm hoping to create here.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer, thank you for your time. We appreciate it. You heard a little bit from the governor on the road tax. John, you sold?
Well, I drive on the road, so I'm sold on that part. I think, have we had a governor elected with a mandate in the last 50 years? If you were going to make a list, she probably was elected with a mandate to fix the roads. And if she had proposed a 20-cent gas tax increase or a 45-cent gas tax increase, she's going to get pegged for raising taxes. So I think she figured, I've got a mandate and I'm going to get attacked for it anyway, so I'm just going to plow forward. And she's sticking to her guns.
Does she stick at the $2.5 billion level? I mean, is she serious about that? Or you think she could walk it home with $1.5 billion and say it was a victory?
I think the challenge that she's presented for herself is that the revenue that she's proposing through this gas tax, while she's saying it's all going to roads, the moving around of other buckets of money to pay for all of her other priorities makes everything hinge on the gas tax. So it's not just the roads. She can't do her education proposal. She can't do her higher education proposal. She can't do her water proposal. She can't do anything unless she gets the gas tax, because she needs the gas tax money to move all the other money that's been put into roads to go back to those other things. So that's why she's putting herself in this box of like, I have to sign something with revenue, because her entire budget, it's not like, oh, we'll just get the roads and we'll focus on that. If this doesn't happen, she gets nothing. So there's nothing.
I tend to think that this is a poker game and this was her opening ante. And I think she knew perfectly well when she did it that it was going to be settled for something less. I have gotten a kick out of the people who actually thought that they weren't going to stay all summer. I thought the minute in the state of the state when she, instead of saying we should get these done by early June, by late June or July, remember the way she worded it. The legislature shouldn't break for vacation until we get it done. To me, she was looking very far ahead when she worded it that way. And
yeah, you should get a Swami hat for that, Jack, because you've been saying that all along.
I was asking the question that night to different people, and they seemed to ignore. I kept trying to say, hey, wait a minute. I think there's
more. It was because I was working, Jack. I didn't want to answer you.
Yeah.
It's because nobody wants to admit their summer already went up in smoke.
Well, I'll tell you, though, my guess is that they'll, of course, as we're all used to, they'll settle it like children. And they'll be fighting and battling all summer long. And I do suspect that there will be something in the middle that comes out of it, a lower increase. It will not be $2.5 billion. It'll be somewhere beneath there someplace. But there's going to be all kinds of twists and turns before we get there.
I think the legislature passes something smaller, and she's going to reject at least one version. What do you think?
Ooh, a governor actually reject a budget until she gets a gas tax? That would be pretty bold.
No, I mean, they may come up with some road funding money, left, but it's going to be significantly less than $2.5 billion, and she rejects it. That's my theory.
She certainly set herself up to do that. I mean, I saw her this last week speak at the Lansing Economic Club luncheon, and she was, I mean, it's early in the game, and she's not going to signal negotiation at this point, but she was rock solid. I'm not doing anything less. Anything less doesn't fix the problem, and I'm not going to be responsible for something that doesn't fix the problem. She really gave her no room to move.
Well, the thing we're being reminded of right now is we haven't had divided government around us in quite a long time. And the last time we did it was a complete disaster of fighting and infighting craziness. She's very skilled at what she's doing. And the governor inherently, by the shape of the office, holds an advantage over the legislature. There's 110 of them talking in the House. There's 38 of them talking in the Senate. The ability for Shirky and Chatfield just to keep their caucuses happy and in line and moving forward, let alone being best friends with each other and talking with one voice up against the governor, is very difficult, especially the longer this goes. So she seems more than ready to play that game out.
The only other thing that I wanted to mention from the interview, near the end of the interview, we asked her about Garland Gilchrist, what his role is going to be going forward, and asked about whether she's going to engage him in the computer problems at DHHS. Given his background, she said that she would. It'd be interested to see how that plays out. That was obviously his expertise before coming to government, and that would be utilizing a talent that he has. Lord knows that they've got a mess over there with the various computer systems.
It was Snyder's talent, too.
Well, no, he was a manager, though. I mean, he didn't actually...
He came from computers, though. Yeah. He built computers. He was in it.
He did.
Well, we'll see how...
It just proves. I mean, every government, state government IT project seems like it's way, way, way too expensive, and it's never right. Never delivers what it's built to deliver.
The buried story in your interview here is this goose problem that we have at prisons. Mm. I mean, we need to get on top of that. That needs to be part of the governor's roadshow PowerPoint, is this goose attacking people, state employees. It's that can't continue.
Jack? Yeah, goose control's been on my mind for, you know, at least 10 minutes now.
You should give them your golf clubs, Jack.
Yeah, they could probably actually hit something with them, which would be, you know, although I'm actually pretty good considering my swing and my lack of attention that I pay toward what I'm doing.
Can you hit a goose better than a ball?
You can't hit a goose. You can swing at a goose.
Why does... Oh, the goose moves too fast?
They know. The ones that have been... It's generational. They've had generations that have lived on golf courses near water hazards, and they know all that stuff. They know where all those balls are underwater. That's the thing that drives
that right?
me crazy, too.
And they bring them up, too, huh?
Well, if you negotiate properly, but I've never been able to.
Let's just note that Jack's the one person who has not had a mimosa so far.
Well, I'm diabetic, and if... I am approximately 30 inches away from them, and I have felt my blood sugar go up by simply being 30 inches away from these things, and not to mention them talking about oatmeal and maple syrup on the oatmeal as well.
With these donuts also in front of your face.
Yeah, I know.
In the non-recyclable containers.
Excuse me, I got to go take a shot right now.
Hey, Jack, maybe it'd be good for you to goose your sugar level.
Oh, gosh. All right. Well, with that, we're going to close the book on this edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Oh, and thanks to John and Matt. And we didn't even talk about your biggest accomplishments together. You are both alum of the Slugnut softball team.
City champs.
Yeah.
Once. We won once, didn't we?
I think so. Selleck wasn't on the team for that one. Or maybe he was, but he only showed up two times.
I kept showing up at Earth Bar waiting for you guys to come.
Well, you know, when you're telling the guy the wrong night in the wrong place, that might mean something. But
no, I wouldn't tell that to Selleck, because he had this innate talent of being able to hit the ball in the exact same spot in left field and get a single every single time. Not a ground ball to the pitcher, not one off the fence, but right in between the center and the left fielder, right over the shortstop.
That's speed, Kyle.
Yeah.
I'm all about speed. Basically, what would happen is I would take the biggest rips possible when I was in the warm-up circle, and I would hear someone out there go, all right, back up those outfielders, back them up.
bloop single.
Well, thanks, guys, for coming in, and thanks for the treats, John. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Hopefully this gets us invited back.
And I would be more than happy. You keep bringing the treats, and you'll get invited quicker than Andrea.
Just bring the mimosas after Lent, though, so I can participate.
All right, thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care. You want this?